During this edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley explains how to best protect yourself from credit card skimmers, which have been found on ATMs and gas pumps in Wisconsin. He'll also discuss buying a house later in life, making the most out of college financial aid, and why you shouldn't necessarily run out to buy the brand new iPhone 7. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, we want to know what personal finance questions you are dealing with today at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Apparently, we have to watch where we are sticking our plastic. We might get skimmed. Kevin, tell us what's going on.
Skimming, Joy, is the crime where thieves insert card readers into the auto pay slots of ATM machines and other gas pumps, any place that you can pay for something with a piece of plastic. And it allows the transaction to be processed, but also for the thieves to grab your credit card or your debit card information. They use that stolen information to make purchases, or they sell it online. And there have been several sites discovered recently throughout the Midwest.
Yeah, where are we finding these skimmers?
The first was found in Wisconsin in August 5th, and they've listed 27 different sites. We'll have a link up to that website that shows all the different gas stations and other terminals that were found to have skimmers on it throughout Wisconsin. About 70 have been found in Michigan. This has been a bigger problem overseas at out-of-the-way locations. And the FICO credit card monitoring service that actually tracks hundreds of thousands of different ATMs around the country, they noted that between 2014 and 2015, there was a 546% increase in the amount of skimmers that they found on various ATM machines. And the problem is big enough that the Wisconsin Department of Agricultural, Trade, and Consumer Protection warned users that you should be very careful about inserting your credit card or your debit card in any type of auto payment device.
This is really a head scratcher. I just can't imagine all these different gas station, gas pumps, ATMs that are being scammed this way. So what happens if our credit card or debit card information is stolen in this manner?
Well, the good news is that your liability is limited as long as you catch it quickly. Credit cards, generally the liability on unauthorized charges is once they finally figure it out that it really wasn't you who made the charge, the liability is zero. On debit cards, that's kind of like a checking account. And if you find it right away, the liability is still zero. Your maximum liability is $50 if you find it within 2 days, and it's up to $500 if you discover the fraud within 60 days. But anything over than that, you might be completely liable from your debit card. And even if you do find it, you discover it quickly, there's the inconvenience of having to replace the card. You might have your assets frozen for a while, and you might need a new card in the meantime.
So what do we do to protect ourselves from skimming?
Well, you can just keep your use only to credit cards because, again, your liability will be limited much better with a credit card than it would be with a debit card. Only use any type of card within the facility because it's obviously difficult to go up to, say, the Quick Trip counter and install a skimmer on there versus trying to find a gas pump in an out-of-the-way place. It's much easier to install one in there. Don't use any machines in dimly lit, out-of-the-way areas. When you're putting your card in, watch out to make sure that the skimmer is fully attached. Now, it looks like it belongs there. If something is loose or it's rattling around in there, there's a decent chance that is a skimmer that's been installed there. Don't use it. And then once you do use your debit or your credit card, and this is a good idea anyway, save your receipt. And then go over your statements carefully in your accounts each month and make sure that the receipts that you have used match up with what shows up on the account. And also, if you're having a joint account with a partner, family member, make sure that they know this as well so that you can compare. They don't just say, oh, well, there's a $50 charge I don't recognize. That was probably my wife. And in the end of this, the best way to avoid any type of skimming fraud is to pay cash and pay inside.
Yeah, that's what most of our Facebook commenters are saying. Just pay in cash. I mean, that is one of the options, I guess.
It's still legal as of today.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Here's an email from a listener named Mary who says, I am 62 and I'm buying a house for the first time, and she wants to know what she needs to know, Kevin.
Good for you, Mary. And some of the basic advice that applies to all home buyers applies to you, too. You should generally not purchase a home, and especially if you have to take out a mortgage, it costs more than three times your gross income. So if you make $50,000 a year, try to keep the purchase price within $150,000. If you are using a mortgage, put 20% down, generally no more and no less. No more because you don't want to use up any of your extra savings that you might need either for an emergency or for some home remodeling in the new place. And no less because then you might have to pay private mortgage insurance. Get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, and then pay it off as slowly as possible.
Are you concerned about Mary buying a home at the age of 62 when a lot of people are thinking about retiring?
Not really. If she's paying in cash, my only concern is that hopefully she'd have enough other money to live on, both from income, eventually from Social Security or a pension, and she'd also have enough other assets to cover emergencies and to pay for other expenses as well. She does have a better chance of qualifying for a mortgage while she's working rather than after retirement. Banks generally like an income figure that they can put in that little box that they need on their software to get your mortgage approved. But she'll probably find that her mortgage payment and the other costs might not be as much more than rent. For instance, if she buys a $200,000 or she has a $200,000 mortgage, her mortgage payment will probably be somewhere around, maybe $1,000 to $1,200 a month. And then once you add in the property taxes and insurance, should be close to $1,500. Now, that, of course, does not include all the maintenance and all the upkeep you need when you do own your own home place. And with her at her age, she may actually be able to buy a house with a big down payment, but no mortgage payment, and an easier application process.
How is it easier?
She can actually buy a home using a reverse mortgage. Again, if you are 62 years old, you do have to put down somewhere usually around 30 to 40% of the purchase price. So again, if she were buying a $200,000 home, she might have to come up with $60,000 or $70,000. But she can then finance the rest with the reverse mortgage. It's an easier approval process than it is to get a traditional mortgage. And then she'll have no mortgage payment ever in the future. The bad news about this is the interest applies to the mortgage, but she never has to repay that mortgage. If she leaves or dies, the house is then sold, and whatever's the remaining balance on the reverse mortgage is repaid, but any surplus goes to her if she's alive or to her estate if she's passed away. But she doesn't owe anything on the deficit. For instance, if she owes $300,000 on the reverse mortgage and then her house is sold for $200,000, she doesn't owe anything on that. So it's kind of a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose proposition.
What though, are the potential drawbacks of that arrangement?
Well, there's a couple small drawbacks and then one big one. One small one is that you do have to maintain the house up to a certain level. You have to pay the taxes and the insurance. The big one is there are some fees to not only obtain the reverse mortgage but also keep it going. And then also the interest on the reverse mortgage accumulates. And so the longer that she has it, the more likely it is that the size of the reverse mortgage is actually going to exceed the value of the home, especially if the home doesn't appreciate a lot in value. So it'll eat up all that home equity that she's built up in the place.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question, a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We do have Mark in Oconomowoc on the line. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I just wanted to go back to the comment you made about the skimmers and the protection. One of the things I do is use a debit card that does not have overdraft protection. And I only keep the money in that debit card that I know that I'm going to be spending in the short term. So I use that for at the gas pump or for all online purchases. So I may only keep a balance of around $100. Worst case, if somebody gets my card, that they can only extract the amount of money that's in there without ever having to go over.
Huh. Yeah, that's a good idea, Mark, and that applies whether it's just a separate account or if you're broke. If you don't have anything, they can't take anything from you.
Very true.
All right. Thanks very much, Mark, for the call. Let's go next to Kyle in Milwaukee. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. I was just calling. My mom recently passed this summer, and I'm 24 years old. She left me $100,000, and I want to buy a rental property, but I also want to invest. And I really don't know how to make that step or where to go or who to talk to or how I start that process.
Well, you start here at On Your Money, Kyle.
That's right.
sorry about your mother's passing, and I am glad to hear that at least she left you something beyond hopefully her love, and you've got some money now, a nice little nest egg to start out. Have you had any experience, Kyle, with owning or maintaining a rental property?
No, but I work as a roofer and sider, I've talked to some people who flip houses who we get jobs from, and I've been slowly gathering information. Their first-hand experience.
Good for you. And the roofer, back me up here, Kyle. That's one of the hardest jobs there is, isn't it?
It's for some people, yeah.
Oh, not for you. Good. That's good to hear. Okay, so here are the things that I like about your situation. One is that you're investigating it. You're taking your time to try to figure out what the right thing is to do. The second thing is that you have experience in home repairs. A lot of people who want to get into this kind of investment, they just concentrate on the cash flow, and they don't realize that there can be a lot of upkeep to it. And not only does this allow you to make repairs yourself rather than paying somebody else to do it, but it also might allow you to buy a place that other people have to shy away from because it needs repairs and it's something they don't have the skill or the ability or maybe even the time to do. And if you have a flexible work schedule, you might have all of those things so you can get yourself a better deal. And finally, the big thing that I love about this is you actually have some cash to invest in it rather than getting a big loan on it and then trying to scrape up a down payment and then being really stuck with high payments for it. What I would do is when you find the property is I would talk to a lender before you even settle on buying the place. Because in an ideal situation, Kyle, what you'd have is you'd not only have the property, but you'd have some cash set aside in a bank account to cover you if, for instance, the renter can't pay or you can't rent the place or it needs a big repair. So you might want to see if you can get a mortgage for it and get as much as the lender will allow and then make the payments as slowly as possible to keep some liquidity for that. And then the second thing about if you have any extra money left over past that property, Kyle, do you have a retirement plan at work or are you on your own in regards to that?
I have no retirement. I've been looking up, seeing I can invest $5,500 the first year for a Roth IRA, I believe.
Yep, very good. And if you're in a lower tax bracket and you may need the money, generally the Roth IRA is best. You don't get a tax break on it, but if you're in a lower tax bracket, that's not as valuable. And you can pull the contributions to a Roth IRA back out whenever you want with no taxes or no penalties whatsoever. So it makes a good idea to set the money aside there. If you are going to be in a higher tax bracket, for instance, if you're single and you're going to gross over about $50,000 a year of income, then it might be better off to get an IRA. You do get a tax deduction on it. It's a little tougher to get the money out. You will pay a small penalty if you pull it out without a good reason before 59 and a half. But that's kind of the cutoff for a single filer, and it's about twice that for married couples filing jointly.
Thank you, Kyle, for the call, and best wishes to you. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, we'll have some advice for families who are going to be applying for financial aid in the very near future, and we will also take more of your personal finance questions for Kevin McKinley. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or even tweet it at Joy Cardine Show. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. who is here to help you with your personal finance issues. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Brian in Wausau is with us next. Hi, Brian. Brian.
Yes, yes. Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for you. Young professional, just coming into a different stage of life where I've got some more disposable income, paid off student loan debt, looking to do something differently with regard to building wealth going forward here in the future, and just curious as to what you believe is the appropriate way of, I've got this sense of whether you stack cash or do you try to invest the money in other means or fashions. I guess I come from more of a tradition of coffee can wealth management, investing in Folgers cans versus maybe doing something a little bit more aggressive or maybe forward-thinking with regard to money management. I'm just curious as to your thoughts.
Yeah, Brian, good question, and this brings up a good point. Coming up in our next pledge drive at the 1st of October and I believe the 4th of October, Joy, we're going to be offering as a premium Young Money Moves. All these things that people like Brian have been asking us, we're going to give all these answers to them, and that premium will be available to people who pledge at any dollar level, so make sure you tune in on October 1st and October 4th. And to answer your question in advance, Brian, do you work as a young professional where you work? Do they have a retirement plan there?
Yes.
Okay. Are you contributing to that?
Yes, I'm maxing that out.
Oh, good for you. That's great. Okay, and then does your income allow you to contribute to a Roth IRA as well?
You know, that's something, honestly, to be, I haven't even considered. I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to some of the other options.
That's okay. We count on that. If everybody knew everything that I knew, we wouldn't have any listeners, so I appreciate your ignorance. The Roth IRA is the next step above and beyond maxing out your 401k account. And again, you don't get a tax break on it, but the earnings grow tax sheltered until you're 59 and a half, after which you can pull the money out and it's all tax-free. And then at any time, you can pull the contribution out for any reason whatsoever with no taxes or penalties. And you can put in up to $5,500 per year. So that's another thing that I use. You can go out and get that Roth IRA on your own. You can go to your bank or your credit union, and they'll usually have just like an interest-bearing account, might only pay 1% or 2%. Or you can call a place like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity. Most financial advisors typically don't work with people with just to make one Roth IRA contribution. But those places, like Vanguard, Roth, or Schwab, Fidelity, Betterment is another one. Wealthfront is kind of an auto balancing and auto investment, what they call a robo-advisor. You can get in with a lower dollar amount and relatively reasonable fees. And then sometimes with those places, they will give you some kind of guidance as to what type of investments you want to do. But you're off to a great start. If you're just contributing and maxing out to your 401k, that's fantastic. And chances are, if you can do that from the time you're 30 to the time you're 60, you'll have more than enough money, then you know what to do with, and still be able to, you know, buy a house or buy a new house or whatever, start a family or whatever you want to do. So definitely max out the 401k contribution, build up the Roth IRA as part of your savings account, and that's actually, I would say, spend the rest if you can cover both of those bases.
Thank you, Brian, for the call. Good luck. Let's go next to Denny in La Crosse. Hi, Denny.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have three pieces of vacant land. Two of them were acquired a long time ago, so there's considerable capital gains involved. Third one I just procured. And I have three adult children, and I want to either gift them or use a trust vehicle to send them to them. I've had a lot of people tell me it's a can of worms and this, that, and the other thing, and I guess they're right because I've been to two different lawyers. And I'm very scratching my head and need some advice here. Between taxes and equitable and all these other terms, I'm very confused.
Yeah, well, it's a good problem to have. And it's like a parable. I mean, you want to be fair to everybody, but then people have different interests and different abilities. Do the kids? Do they all want the land, or will some of them sell it? Will they develop it? What kind of land is it?
None of it exceeds more than 10 acres.
Okay.
One is just a lot. Each one is different, and the values are different. And the kids, and I've told them this, we've talked about it openly. I said, it's not like a heritage farm or something that has high emotional meaning to me. If you sell it, you're not going to hurt our feelings. You know? So I don't have that emotional roadblock, but it just seems incredibly complex, and I can't seem to find the right advice or lawyer.
Well, two good things that jumped out at me. One is the fact that you've communicated with them. A lot of times it's difficult for families and especially multiple generations to talk about money at all. And the kids, if they're decent, they don't want to appear greedy. But, they're most times kids end up getting some or all of their parents' assets anyway. So it's just a natural course of events. And the second thing is that you don't have any emotional attachment to it. Sometimes people say, gosh, I'm going to give you this, but here's what I want you to do with it. Well, with those strings attached, sometimes that can add some stress and make things more difficult. Is when you talked about the taxes, is the land... can you give me a rough idea like what one of the parcels is worth? I'm assuming they're all worth about the same dollar amount.
Yeah, the two that I bought over a decade ago, are probably $150,000, and they'd sell in a heartbeat for that.
Okay.
And they were purchased for a fraction of that.
Okay.
The third one was purchased recently, and so therefore, in my mind, I paid $100,000 for it, so it's... That's current numbers, so it's worth $100,000.
Yeah, okay. Well, here's what I would do is if you're going, and it sounds like you're interested in actually giving one parcel to each kid, not having them share ownership in all three, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you can get around gift taxes because you can technically only give $14,000 of value or cash to any one person in any one year without filing a gift tax return. But even if you do give above that amount, you do have to file a gift tax return. All that means is you don't pay any extra taxes. You just use up your lifetime gift exemption, which is about, I think it's about $5.4 million or something right now. And so you can get out of gift taxes with it. And then if and when the kids sell it, because you're alive right now and you're gifting it, their cost basis is your cost basis. But I'm guessing they're probably in a lower tax bracket than you are?
Probably two of them are.
Okay. The one who's not... you might want to give the one that doesn't have a big profit on it because that one might pay a higher tax rate on it. Otherwise, if and when they do choose to sell it, they're probably going to sell. They're probably going to pay long-term capital gains tax rates on there, which are very low. They can be as low as zero for people in a low tax bracket, probably not on a property like this. But at the most, that could be, it's maybe 15 to 20% of the gain. And so another way to do this is say, look, we're going to give these to you. You guys sell them, do with them what you want. If and when you choose to sell it, you might be responsible for the taxes. Or, Jerry, you might offer... Denny, you might offer to say to them, look, I'm going to give this to you, and if you're going to turn around and sell it because you got a bigger tax bill than your siblings did, I'll pay the capital gains tax bill liability for you.
All right, Denny, thanks very much for the call. Next we go to Colleen in Madison. Hi, Colleen, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. A while back, I heard your guest talk about a formula. I have a daughter that's going to be a freshman in college next year regarding how much loans to take out compared to the degree that they're going to be graduating with. There was a formula that gave a ratio. I'm wondering if he could repeat that.
He can. And again, that's one more item that we will be including in the Young Money Moves premium at the end of the first part of October in our pledge drive. But I will tell it to you, Colleen, what I'd like to see people do when they're considering how much to borrow to get a higher education degree is look at that particular school and those particular majors and find out what the median salary is or the average earnings are for the first year for people who graduate from that school with that major, and then find out how many of those graduates are actually employed in that particular field. Not employed, but employed in that particular field. So let's say she is going to be a nurse, and let's say she finds out that people who graduated in nursing from that particular school made on average $40,000. And then that 90% of them were employed as nurses within the first year of graduation. You would take the $40,000 of the average earnings multiplied by the employment rate, which is 90%, and that gives you a figure of $36,000. And as a rule of thumb, that's a reasonable amount to borrow to get that particular degree.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Colleen. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It is time now for Smart Assets. And families of college students can begin filing for financial aid in a few days. And most of them want to know how to get as much financial aid as possible. So where should they start, Kevin?
Now, they should start very soon. It used to be that if you had a student attending college, say in the fall of 2017, the first time you could file for financial aid on the federal formula, which is known as the FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, was January 1st of that particular year. So they'd have to wait till January 1st. Well, now the rules are changing a little bit. Now you can file as early as October 1st of 2016 for a student who will be attending college in the fall of 2017. You don't have to file now, but some schools offer financial aid on a first-come, first-served basis. So the sooner you can do it, the better. And as a reminder, when you are trying to get as much aid as you possibly can, that's something you should try to pursue. But most financial aid comes from loans, which eventually have to be repaid, including interest. And just because you get a very good financial package or a very good school or a very good student in there, it doesn't mean that you're going to get a lot of financial aid. There are a lot of students applying to go to college who have 3.5, 3.8 grade point averages, lots of extracurricular activities, good test scores, and so that doesn't mean that you're going to stand out. The more unique you are, generally the more likely you are to get some kind of financial aid. And even if you do get grants or scholarships, you have to figure out the net cost. Sometimes schools that charge, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 a year in total cost might offer a $20,000 or $30,000 scholarship, but you're still going to pay $30,000 or $40,000 a year for that particular school. And finally, yes, there are ways to qualify for need-based financial aid, even if you do have some assets, but it's very difficult to keep those assets and get the aid as well. You can't have your cake and eat it too.
Understood, but how can families make sure that they qualify for as much need-based aid as possible?
Younger families should start out by actually saving as much as possible for retirement right now before the kids go off to college, because assets in retirement plans like 401ks and IRAs, and generally even Roth IRAs, aren't included in the expected family contribution formula. But your contributions that you make while your kid is in college are included in that. The school financial aid formulas and the federal formula say, well, you know, you could do anything with that money. Just because you're saving for retirement doesn't mean you couldn't actually stop saving for retirement and put it towards your kid's education. So even though you put that money in the 401k, we're still going to start counted as parental income. So definitely use Roth IRAs as possible to save all the money you can, because, again, you can get at the contributions if you want at any time, but they're sheltered from the financial aid formula. Keep in mind, though, that if you do actually tap a retirement account like a Roth IRA and pay for college, the next year when you apply for financial aid, that will show up as income because it figures into the income formula.
What about saving money in a child's name? Is that a good idea?
That's generally something you do not want to do, because it not only counts at a higher ratio in the expected family contribution, about 20% of assets are included, of child assets are included in the formula, but if it's actually in the kid's name using the kid's Social Security number, the kid can do with the money whatever he or she wants once reaching the age of adulthood. She doesn't have to spend it on school. She can buy a car or take a vacation if she wants. If you've already saved money in the kid's name, start looking to liquidate it on acceptable expenses. This might be a computer for the kid or braces, or if you feel the need to buy a car for the kid, that's also an acceptable expense. And then money that you otherwise would have spent on those things, put that into a 529 in your own name. If the kid has working earned income while in high school, you can put that money into the Roth IRA, or you can match the contributions to a Roth IRA. She doesn't necessarily have to make the contributions herself. But again, any money in the kid's name, spend that money first, even if it's just on the first year of school. possible. You want to liquidate that as quickly as possible, and so that in future years when you apply for need-based financial aid, that doesn't show up as such a significant factor. And then any money you want to save in the future, that should go into parent-owned 529 plans, college savings plans like Wisconsin's EdVest plan. If it's owned by the parent, it doesn't count into the financial aid formula at all. If it's owned by a it's a parent asset, but if it's owned by a grandparent, it's not included at all in the formula. But then what happens is once you pull the money out, then you have to declare it in the formula for next year. So ideally, if grandparents have some money saved up in a 529 for grandchildren, they want to pull that money out in the last year of the kid's school, because that will also be the last year in which the kid needs money for school, so you won't be applying for financial aid anymore.
What about the child's, if the child has a job, will a working student's earnings affect need-based financial aid?
Yeah, that's an interesting situation, because, you know, you'd like to say, hey, kid, you know, we're putting up a lot of money towards your education. Can you help out by working? But that can be one of the worst things to do when it comes to need-based financial aid. Now, work-study jobs, generally, the income from those are not counted in that. As a matter of fact, to get a work-study job, you have to usually apply for financial aid. But other kinds of earnings can get hit pretty hard. And it's usually there's a figure where they say, all right, the kid can earn $6,400 a year, let's say. But after that, 50% of the earnings goes towards the expected family contribution. So not only is the kid losing money out for taxes, et cetera, but they're also losing for financial aid. So between the low wages kids usually make while they're in college and the amount of time it occupies, unless it's really good experience, like let's say they want to be a lawyer and so they've got a job as a receptionist in a law office. Unless it's really good experience, it might be better off for the kid to not work at all and borrow actually more money and take a bigger class load and get in and get out sooner, because the living expenses, you know, are half the cost of college. And the longer you go to college, the more living expenses you have. And getting in and getting out quickly is a great way to shave a substantial amount off the total cost.
I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network, and our next caller is Jerry in Partyville. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, good morning. My wife and I are considering moving into we're both retired and considering moving into a smaller home. And I'm just wondering how to finance the newer home if we are not able to sell our current home at the same time. And I'm thinking a short-term loan or maybe a home equity loan or something like that. And what are your thoughts?
What I would do, Jay, do you have a home picked out already, or are you just kind of mulling over what your next steps are?
Well, it's a retirement community, and we're on a waiting list, so it can pop up at any time.
Okay. Have you talked to a lender yet?
No.
Okay. Were you planning on paying cash from the proceeds from the sale of the old place for the spot in the retirement community?
Yes.
Okay. What I would do is go to your bank or credit union and explain your situation, and you will not be the first nor the most convoluted person they see that day who has this kind of question. And you're just trying to kind of bridge it and say, well, what happens if we get this place but we can't sell our house? And depending on your situation, they may have a solution for you, like a short-term loan. They may even give you a mortgage on the new place or some kind of loan that would allow you just to make small payments until you actually sell the old one. And if your credit is good, you have other assets for it, you have a decent chance of getting some kind of bridge loan for them. But I would talk to them for it. And then do this for yourselves as well, Jerry. Right now, have you had an appraisal done of your current place?
Yes.
Okay. Was it by an appraiser or was it by a realtor?
Realtor.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was just clearing my throat.
No, the realtor's opinion is valid generally, but I would have an appraiser do it as well, because the appraiser is actually, if the people have to borrow money to buy your home, the appraiser's opinion is what's going to matter most. And that will give you a better idea of what a potential buyer will hear when they go to the bank to get a mortgage to buy your place. And it not only allows you to maybe be a little more optimistic about what you think you're going to get from it if the appraiser comes in for it, say your house is priced at $150,000 and the people say, we only think it's worth $130,000, that's all we're going to offer. You can say, hey, I've had an appraisal done. This is what they said. So when you go to the bank to get a mortgage, this is what the mortgage will be for a $150,000 house. Or it might give you a more realistic valuation. So if the appraiser says, sorry, you might think it's worth 150, but we only are going to say it's worth 125 or 130 to the bank. So that'll give you a better idea of what's it going to do. It's going to cost you about $400 or $500 maybe to have the appraisal done, but it can be invaluable not only to giving you leverage with potential buyers, but in getting a realistic valuation of what the home actually is going to be worth if and when you do sell it. So I'd talk to a lender. It's perfectly fine asking them about it. Worst thing they can do is say no. And then also get an appraisal done of your place by a real appraiser.
Good luck, Terry. Coming up, if you have your eyes on an iPhone 7 and can't wait to get one, Kevin will explain why you might want to hold off for the time being. Plus, we'll take more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. And it is time now for Shop Around. The latest version of the iPhone has been announced, but Kevin, you say that most of us should not get caught up in all the excitement and hold off. Tell us more about this new phone.
Well, this is the iPhone 7 and a slightly bigger version of the iPhone 7. And one thing you really, you know, Apple has more money than God, and they're, I think, the world's most valuable company on a per share times the number of shares basis for it too. But you can tell that they're running into a little bit of trouble because they can't generate the big interest. Now, remember when, you know, Steve Jobs he'd be up there in the black mock turtleneck and the jeans, and he'd be pointing out all the features on stage, and people would be oohing and aahing.
Right.
Well, they don't do that as well anymore, and it doesn't receive the hype. But the new features are slightly better battery, better photography with this phone. It's water resistant, not waterproof, water resistant. The sound is a little better. The sound comes out of the phone speaker, and there's a little more storage on it. And then because there's no headphone jack on these anymore, they removed that. That also allowed them to slim it down a bit as well. It is available now, but not everywhere. Some places say, yeah, we've got more than we know what to do with. Other places say, no, we're sold out and there's a waiting list.
Yeah. And I heard some people are really outraged over that, the elimination of that headphone jack. Why shouldn't we go get one just yet?
Well, there are several reasons. First of all, it's an extra cost. If you have to switch to a new phone or a new plan, where they're going to pay several hundred dollars for it. And there's a question of whether all that extra money is really worth the features that you're getting for it. It's only just a little bit better as well. And then there are, you know, the replacement cost. If you get those wireless headphones, it's an add-on. Those are $160 if you lose them. And I know I probably go a day before I would lose at least one of those plugs and probably both of them for. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, there are other options for it. The iPhone 7 does include a plug and an adapter that you can use traditional headphones with as well.
But you know, what if I'm in the market for a new phone anyway?
Well, depending on your situation, it might be a very good time to buy an upgrade. First of all, you know, how many ever years ago, 2 years ago, the iPhone 6 came out, and there was a huge amount of fanfare about that. Well, guess what? You can get that phone now for basically free as long as you have a data or voice plan on it. So those still work very well, and there's not a huge decline between the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 6. Some providers are offering credit for upgrading to the iPhone 7, and it may actually make it less expensive on your plan to get a new one rather than keep the old one. And also, other brands of smartphones are meeting the same kinds of prices that are coming out with the iPhone 7, and they're offering discounts as well to try to get you to switch from an iPhone or maybe stay with them as well. So you can shop for other, like Samsung, the Galaxy, or whatever. Although, keep in mind, we've had issues with the Samsung Galaxy. I think the 7 has had enough instances of it starting on fire, spontaneously combusting, that Samsung actually had to release a patch and a new software update, and they said you should only use your phone to about 60% of the battery capacity for it as well. But if you do upgrade to any kind of new phone, make sure you're considering all the costs of the phone, not just the price of the phone, but also if you're switched to a different data plan, because the data plan plan information can be very confusing. So we're going to talk next week about how to make sure you're getting the best options to get good cell service data, phone calls, but getting it at the lowest possible price.
Yeah, I thought I saw in the news, too, that there's been a formal recall of those Samsung phones because of that fire problem.
And that's and if you know certain phone users, I have three of them who are my spawn in my home. If you say to them, I have to take your phone away for a while, it needs to get fixed so it doesn't start a fire, they'll start shaking and twitching and foaming at the mouth and everything. So yeah, you might want to be very careful about how you handle that.
So if we decide to upgrade to a new phone, what should we do with our old phone?
Well, keep in mind, it probably has some value. The newer that it is, the more like it is, you can probably trade it in. Apple probably has the best trade-in values for iPhones. You can go to apple.com, and they actually have a list of what they'll value each version of the phone for. And you can sell it yourself if you want. You can also donate it as well. There's things where you can donate it for soldiers or domestic violence victims that you can give a phone to so they can call if they have trouble for it. Or you can just do it for a tax deduction as well. But make sure you wipe it clean when you do so. And some people, you know, especially if they have an older smartphone, you may just want to keep it, not only to serve as a backup in case you do lose your new one or it's recalled and you have to give it up for a while, but also just to have it as like a small tablet. You know, you can use Wi-Fi with those without having a data plan, and it can serve as a nice little, as long as you can actually see that small screen.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Ashley in Green Bay is with us now. Hello, Ashley.
Hi. I have a question about the Federal Student Loan Forgiveness Program. I know it benefits public employees, but does it benefit private sector employees at all?
Generally not. There are ways to get some of a loan forgiven, actually. It depends on the loan. Is it a federal loan or is it a private student loan?
They're both. I have a lot of student debt. So.
Okay. You have a couple different options. Have you heard about the income-based repayment plan for student loans?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Have you checked out to that to see if you can get in on that?
No, I have not.
Okay. Go to, I think it's IBRinfo.org. That's IBRinfo.org. And what they will do is you put in your information on both the amount of debt you have outstanding and your income. And depending on those variables, they might give you the option of slowing down the payments on your federal student loans and still keeping you in their good graces so you're not in default. And then eventually, if you make the smaller payments for a long enough period of time, they may forgive your balance. Now, it's a long time, and it's not going to be a ton of money because you're hopefully going to be paying some of this down. So go to IBRinfo.org and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. And you can't get out of it for the private sector or for private student loans, but you may be able to reduce the payments that you're making on your federal student loans.
And I would guess, Kevin, that you'll have more information on student loan debt in your Young Money Moves pamphlet.
Yes, we will. We have a ton of information on more about when you should borrow, when you shouldn't. A lot of people, we get very responsible people call us and say, hey, I'm actually out of school and I have a job and I have some money and I want to get these loans paid off as quickly as possible, which is very understandable, but that may not be the best move. You may be better off saving the money for other purposes and just making the minimum loan payments required.
That, again, is Kevin's mini money booklet that he's putting together as your thank you gift for the pledge drive coming up. It's going to be Saturday, October 1st. We'll be a live On Your Money. Normally, our Saturday broadcast is a rebroadcast of this hour, but because we have our pledge drive, we will be live on Saturday, October 1st, and again on Tuesday, October 4th. And we will be talking a lot about young money moves at that time. Let's go to Marie in Waukesha next. Hi, Marie. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We are 65 years old. We are retired, and we are going to test the waters in buying a second home, which we hope ends up being the permanent home, and selling our current home. we have a house that's worth $900,000, and we owe $300,000 on it. And we have investments that are earning 8 to 9% the last couple of years. So the question is, should we take out a second mortgage to buy this home, or should we take from our investments.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, you're sounding like you're in a good situation, Maria, and it's a good question to have. A lot of the people I work with in my grown-up job have the same kind of dilemma, which is a good problem to have. A couple things. One is I would caution you on the investments earning 8 to 9%. They have earned 8 to 9% maybe over the last couple of years. That means that they've taken a great deal of risk to get that high reward. And that means that they're more likely to go down if things get bad. And so that's one reason why I would say, you know, you may be better off liquidating some of those investments to pay cash for a new place. However, you get more flexibility if you can get a mortgage for the new place as well. And then from your financial situation, it sounds like you'd probably be able to get a mortgage for the new place, even though you have a mortgage on the old one. The one thing I would do is if you do get that new mortgage, I would definitely make your portfolio more conservative so that you didn't have a big loss that went down just as you were thinking about maybe selling the old place. Depending on the area, $900,000 of trying to sell a place of that nature can be very difficult, especially if times are tough. People tend to scale back their purchases a lot, and it's harder to sell a higher priced home like that. So I would want you to either pay cash from the investments, or I would want you to get a new mortgage for the new place, but then also make those other investments more conservative. You may give up on some future reward, but more importantly, you'll hopefully avoid a future loss.
Well, and our thinking was to take the money out of the investments because with the elections this fall, I think life is extremely uncertain, but real estate will hold.
Well, that could happen. If it does, you definitely want to wait. We're going to talk about that next week and about the election. You know, we always are going to have uncertainty when we invest money. That's been around forever. I'm more concerned about where prices of securities are in relation to their value. We're in the seventh year of a general upturn in not only investment asset prices, but also economic expansion. There's a big question is whether or not this economic expansion is organic, meaning is it self-sustaining, or is it because the Federal Reserve has artificially lowered interest rates? There are lots of reasons to be concerned. The election is probably not one of them, but again, we'll be talking about that next week.
Thank you, Marie. Now we go to Mark, who is listening in Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Oh, boy, we have a bad connection, so if you could be as brief as possible, Mark.
I'm sorry.
Maybe it sounds like you're on a speakerphone or something. You got to speak right into the receiver of your phone for us to hear you correctly. Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess that's not going to work. So instead, sorry, Mark. Can't hear you. Rick emails, at 70, I have $400,000 in cash and I want a low-risk option. I have a comfortable income and retirement portfolio. What is your opinion on bonds versus bond funds? How about that, Kevin?
My opinion is that they share attributes and drawbacks. And the nice thing about buying bond funds is for a relatively small amount of money, sometimes in as little as $1,000, you can get a wide portfolio of bonds from which to draw. You might have in a mutual fund, you might have 500 or 1,000 different bonds that your $1,000 is spread among, which helps mitigate the risk. The disadvantage of bond funds is that you don't know where the money is invested, you don't know when you will get your principal back, if ever, and you don't know what the interest rate will be in any given month. The interest rate can go up and down depending on lots of different factors for it. And then in some bond funds, there are expenses that can be very high and, in fact, can eat up a lot of the return that the bonds within the portfolio provide. So if you have a larger amount of money, and I'd consider the $400,000 a decent enough size investment pool where he might be able to just buy individual bonds, the bad news is he's going to be limited to the number of bonds he can buy, and he's probably going to have to go out several years before those bonds mature, which then reduces the liquidity of trying to get that money out early. One of the best ways someone like him can take advantage of a bond-like portfolio but still get better liquidity is to buy certificates of deposit. By buying the CDs, you know, you might get 1% to 2% yield, which if you've shopped around lately, you know that that's actually competitive with other safe investments out there. But with CDs, you generally can pull the money out whenever you want with a small penalty for early withdrawal, usually 6 months to 12 months worth of interest. So not only does Rick know where the money is in the CD, but he knows there's going to be relatively little cost to get out of it, and he knows at a certain date that he's going to get his money back. And FDIC insurance or NCUA insurance, if it's at a credit union, are still two of the safest ways to invest your money.
Time for the website of the week.
The Department of Agricultural Trade and Consumer Protection in Wisconsin helped us out, getting us lots of information on this skimming problem. So we're going to help them out by pointing you to their website, datcp.wi.gov.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, with us each week at this time for information and advice on your money. Thanks to Bill Martins and Brianne Shasso for producing the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.